When she was a little girl, she played under the piano while her father's piano trio rehearsed. And when she went to sleep at night, it was to a house full of open doors, open onto the sound of music. It's little wonder that a woman born to a life of music became a professional musician. This is Conversations. I'm Susan McInnes. Please welcome with me today Louise DiTullio, flutist. Welcome.
Thank you.
And thank you for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here.
I think I heard you correctly say that the DiTullio family was a family where all the men were musicians and all the women were professional listeners. Is that so?
That's true.
That's right.
That's very true. Although one of the ladies was also an artist. She painted. Uh-huh. And quite beautifully.
Now, this goes back on both sides, not just the DiTullios. There were musicians in both sides of the family?
My mother's family was named De Robertis. And there are branches of that family, the children, some of them became professional musicians. My mother's oldest brother was a French horn player. They're the wind players. Huh. My dad's side were the string players. And the leading French hornist in Hollywood for many, many, many years, he's still playing a little bit, and he's over 70 years old, Vincent De Rosa, mm-hmm. which is a famous name among horn players, is my first cousin. And another cousin, also first cousin out of my mom's family, our mothers were all sisters, was the principal French hornist of the L.A. Philharmonic for many years, and his name was Henry Sigismonti. So that's the other side.
You were literally surrounded by music from the time you were born then.
It's all I ever knew. I learned to read notes before I learned to read words.
What a surprise. Well, I guess not a surprise for your family. And did, this is a personal question, did music bring your families together? Did your mother's side and your father's side meet over music?
They were sort of the Hatfields and the McCoys. It's a long story.
Oh.
So the ladies in the family were always very close, and I mean the men sort of were respectful of one another, but mostly we hung out with my dad's side.
Interesting. But you and your sister kind of broke the mold of good listeners and both became professional musicians.
That's true. We were encouraged. My sister was the pianist in the family, is the pianist, and she grew up accompanying my father's cello students from about the age of 12, and that was her training.
I see. And is she an accompanist now, or is she a soloist performing musician as you are?
No, she's an accompanist and does a lot of piano teaching and accompanies many people's classes of students. She doesn't do too much on the professional stage aside from what she does with me.
Mm-hmm. And is your accompanist in recitals and other solo
yes,
performances
uh-huh.
often?
Uh-huh.
And is she also in the LA area?
Yes, she is. We live about now 2 miles apart.
This is Louise DiTullio with us on Conversations, flutist in the L.A. area, born in L.A., raised in L.A., and makes her home in Los Angeles, where she plays for several orchestras and also recording for film soundtracks, a studio recording musician. I'm Susan McInnes, and this is Conversations. Now, I understand you started out with the piano, but went to flute. What attracted you to the flute?
I didn't know the first thing about it, except that I have an early memory in the first grade of being taken to the gym at my grammar school, and we heard records, and I heard a record of the piccolo playing Pop Goes the Weasel, and I thought that was just terrific. But it was to be another 6 years before I actually saw a flute or a piccolo, and it was because I think I couldn't follow in my sister's shoes in terms of, you know, the competition and achieving what she is 6 years older, you know, she had quite a jump on me. And I think musicians are naturally competitive anyway. And it just wasn't my thing. I always wanted to play the cello, and that wasn't going to be.
Because?
We had three fabulous professional cellists in the family, and my dad kind of stood in the way of it for whatever his reasons were. And when he finally saw that I was going to quit the piano anyway, you know, I was too old for the cello, and he picked through the orchestra and string instruments starting that late, it's kind of hard. And he didn't want me to have to scrape reeds. He'd watched that and thought that wasn't good. And brass players aren't, you know, brass instruments aren't feminine. So that left a flute. And he brought a flute and a friend who was a flutist and a teacher home one night. And I tried it, and that was it. That was it. I was playing. 6 months later, I was in a youth orchestra, and a year later, I was playing in community orchestras in the LA area, and just took off.
So this tells me this absolutely was your instrument, the one that lit the fire under you.
Absolutely. And having had the piano background that I had, and this is a lesson for parents, you can go from that to just about anything. I used to sight read. I loved to play. I hated to practice the piano. And I would take all my sister's music that was much too difficult for me, but I would put it up and I would play. And my mother died, I would go and play at the variety shows that the school would have every month or so. And I'd pick up a piece the night before, and she said, "You can't do that. You don't know it." And she said she'd go, being prepared to be absolutely embarrassed. And I would play the darn thing. But I didn't want to practice. That wasn't for me, but it was obvious that music was. So.
Now, what is this? It is the repetition of practice that you don't like and the discovery of sight reading that you do like? Is this new ground?
Well, with the piano, I think I wanted to hear the sounds and all. But it didn't inspire me in the way that I needed to be inspired to put in as a pianist 8 hours a day. Yes. You know, if you're really going to do that, somehow it didn't touch me the way a flute will. But what I was going to say was going from multi-note kinds of things to single line was like incredibly easy, and it made me a wonderful sight reader, and it made learning a single line instrument, all I had to do was learn the instrument. I didn't have to learn to read notes or anything like that. And of course, the sight reading skills have played very much into a whole lifetime of work that requires one to sight read every day.
Absolutely. Go back to your admonition to parents. What makes the piano the perfect instrument for a budding musician on any instrument?
Just that. One learns the basics and the fundamentals of learning to read notes, learning to read rhythms, harmonies, what things sound like in more than one line. And you learn a coordination and a discipline there, and then when you go to another instrument, those things are behind you and you learn to play the instrument.
I see. Interesting. To parents, begin with the piano.
It made me as a teacher, you know, I could sit down and accompany not real technical things, but many things for my students. Mm-hmm. It's been a great help.
So not only does it start you out, but it gives you an ability to diversify, to be flexible in what you can do in life.
Yes.
Too.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Going from piano to a typewriter was a piece of cake.
Of course.
The hand-eye coordination thing that one learns goes for a lifetime. I learned to type. My first speed test was 42 words a minute, and I never looked back. I got in excess of 90 words a minute when the band and orchestra teacher in my high school said, no, you can't not be in these groups. And he hauled me out of my typing class, which enrolled me screaming and kicking in the school band, which actually turned out okay.
I'm surprised about the screaming and kicking part. Interesting.
Because I did so much outside of school. I was playing in 4 community orchestras. Mm-hmm. I didn't feel like I needed to do any more of that at a level that wasn't the same, even. But it was fun.
When you look back on your childhood, how do you characterize it? Is this a wonderful place to be raised, or also a kind of a fraught, competitive environment to be raised in? No one's childhood is simple, so I'm certainly not assuming that one way or the other, but I'm just curious.
Good question. Certainly everything was geared around music. You know, my father's concerts, his cello students, he taught 10 hours a day, Saturday and Sunday. He was a true workaholic, along with working, you know, 5 days a week. It meant for us no vacations. He was under contract to Warner Brothers and then 20th Century Fox. And they gave them their holidays in October, which was, you know, for family, an impossibility. And there was a lot of confusion in the house, you know, he was either practicing if he was there or teaching. And my sister was practicing the piano several hours a day, and I was practicing the flute, and in between the telephone rang incessantly, and I've laughed many times. One learns to concentrate in that kind of an atmosphere. But it wasn't easy.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't. There were things about it that were absolutely joyful. The trio, the family trio, was a social event, among other things. And it gave my dad an opportunity. He was a fabulous teacher and an instinctive musician. He taught me more about the flute and music than any flute teachers I ever had. If he saw that I wasn't getting something that he felt I needed to be doing, he would think about who he felt did the best at that thing, and he would go pick their brains and come home and work with me.
What an extraordinary library you had in that man then, reference library.
Oh, yeah. And even in terms of the piano, Roderick Tay, who accompanied me for the recital last night, I had Xeroxed some of my sister's piano parts. She will not let them out of her sight because they either don't come back or her fingerings are gone or something. In one particular piece, he said, "Are these your sister's fingerings?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "They're really very, very good. You know, they're remarkably good." And I can remember so many times my dad using his incredible logic to work out things that weren't necessarily pianistic, but that worked.
That's something.
So it was wonderful, fabulous training.
Gifts.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting gifts. Gifts are always two-sided, of course. But yeah.
Yeah, that's true. Mm-hmm. One gets and one gives up something, too. Mm-hmm.
Louise DiTullio is our guest today on Conversations. She is a flutist from Los Angeles, the principal flutist for the Pacific Symphony and the Pasadena Symphony, as well as the New Hollywood Bowl Orchestra. The New Hollywood Bowl Orchestra plays off seasons, summer seasons in the Hollywood Bowl, and is an orchestra created by Philips to create recordings for the Philips Recording Company. She has been a member of the Pacific Symphony since 1981 and of the Pasadena Symphony since 1978. Louise is also on the faculty of Santa Barbara's Music Academy of the West and California State University at Fullerton. This is Conversations on KUAC. I'm Susan McInnes. You also record for films, the soundtracks. You were talking a minute ago about sight reading, mm-hmm. and this must be an extraordinary exercise in sight reading. Am I right about that?
You're right about that.
Tell us what happens. You go into a recording studio. There are musicians there and a composer?
Musicians there and a composer or mm-hmm. conductor. The composer might be in the booth. Very often he will be the one to conduct as well. And there's music you've never seen before on the stand.
This is an amazing thing to me.
It's all been tailor-made to fit the film. And timed out, they'll call a number, which is to fit a certain scene, and project it on the screen, or more and more now on video, so we get to see less and less of what we're accompanying. But and we're required to sight read. And sometimes with motion picture projects, there's a little more time, but we're required, as with John Williams in the score to Hook, which was probably as difficult a thing as I've ever seen. And if you're familiar with that at all or got the CD and listened, there are a billion notes and they go by 100 miles an hour. And you get that job done. I mean, somehow or another, you have to be able to play it. And at sight, and there's no time to go home and practice the hard things.
Is one of the skills here fitting your part into the whole of the music as well as into some sort of visual environment? Is that, how many skills do you feel you're calling on?
The visual environment is the problem of the composer.
Of course, all right.
He has to have written music that fits that, and he has to see to it that in terms of time and in terms of fitting the emotions of the scene that he's done that job properly. It can be my job, however, to take what he's written and make the mood of what I play fit the mood that he intended. And very often that means, particularly in low-budget things where they don't have a lot of time, hearing the background, and flute is a solo instrument, so yes. I may have a solo that'll run on for 16 or 32 bars, and I have to know at sight and from what I hear in terms of the background that he's created exactly how to play that solo the lengths of notes in the character, and whether it's sad or whether it's fun or whether it's just plain poignant. I mean, there is a difference.
Mm-hmm. Now, does he or does the conductor say to you, Louise, I want this poignant, or is this your intuitive ability that is literally in a foot race with time to bring
mostly
up the right sound?
Mostly it's intuitive ability. Mm-hmm. And if that isn't working, then he'll say something.
I see. I want to talk some more about working for film, but I'd like very much for you to introduce both our aural and visual audiences to this instrument that you play. Can you do this? First of all, this is a gold flute.
This is a gold flute, and the fittings and the keys are all done on this one in silver.
Mm-hmm. Why gold?
This is not an instrument that was made specifically for me.
Okay.
It was made by a manufacturer whose instruments I was playing. And I've gotten more than one story. He's an interesting character, so I'm not exactly sure how it came into my hands, except that he always wanted me to have one of his gold flutes. So,
very nice.
And it sort of worked. It took me about a year to learn to play this thing comfortably, and I still notice there are times that control-wise, I'm not 100%. It's been about 2 years that I've been working with this.
For a non-musician, what is it that takes time to... what is that?
The response, of the instrument, and there's a thing called resistance. And it may be the way the metal itself and the tubing vibrates, or it may simply be the cut of the hole at the head joint. The way the airstream, when you blow at it, it's split. It's divided, and part of the column will go into the instrument and vibrate. Part of it goes over the top. And the cut and the depth of this, what we call the back wall, mm-hmm. will change the way in which it will respond to certain notes or high register or low register or articulations and things.
So you're constantly adjusting both three things, your lip, your ear, and the range of air that you're blowing across it to this back wall.
Very good.
I see.
Very good.
am I learning? What makes the sound? Is it the tube or the valves or both?
The keys adjust the length of the tubing that's vibrating.
Oh,
where it's vented will change how long the tubing is.
Vented changes. I see.
So that if you have all the keys closed, you the whole tube will be vibrating.
So you're using the whole tube. If you start cutting them off, you're using portions of
that's
that
correct.
Tube. I see. And the farther down, the
lower.
The lower.
And then you're working on, for anyone who understands this, the fundamentals of one octave. And then as a trumpet or any brass instrument uses the overtone series. The same holds true here. The upper octave gets into some complicated fingerings to adjust the length of the tubing and what vibrates.
Adjust the length of the tubing. Isn't that interesting? Where does this instrument come from? How are you on history? Anything at all? Does it have a long history, a short history?
Well, to make it very simple, because I'm not a big one in history, but flutes have been time immemorial as long as people are. Something about it, apart from singing, is the closest thing to singing in terms of human expression. And people have been carving wood and making clay flutes and carving bone and whatever, you know, reeds, bamboo. Many, many variations of things to blow through and make flute-like sounds for as long as there were people. And over the last several centuries, it has been evolving from like a simple bamboo flute or a piece of wood that's been hollowed out with some holes that the fingers could cover to gradually people in the last century started inventing a key which would enable them to get a half step, say, rather than just what the fingers could cover. And gradually it evolved into this very complicated series of keys. And the flute as we know it was born somewhere around in the 1830s, I believe.
It's a beautiful instrument. I mean, physically, for something that is essentially a tube, it's gorgeous.
Yeah, they are pretty. Of course, the original ones were wood. Mm-hmm. And
then they added metal keys, right?
When they added metal keys, but I mean the modern flute was first of wood. Mm-hmm. And evolved, I think, not until this century or late in the last century into metal. Mostly silver, some gold. There are some white gold instruments out there and a very few platinum flutes.
Which will have a slightly different sound and...
Slightly different sound. The metal will vibrate differently and it's much heavier to hold up. I mean, some people complain even about the weight of gold, which is heavier than silver.
Interesting. Would you play a bit for us? You said there was a short piece you might favor us with?
The Syrinx of Debussy, and I'm going to warn you and the audience, I came here not knowing when I came to Fairbanks that this interview was going to happen. So this is not something that I've practiced, and I will hope I remember.
That's lovely.
Thank you.
Yes. The Syrinx of Debussy, performed for us by Louise de Tullio. Are there pieces of music that you never grow tired of, that are always engaging you on some level or another? Or is this a...
I hadn't thought about that. I don't know. I think the Mozart flute concertos never grow old, although I asked Jean-Pierre Rampal once if it ever did for him. I've never had the opportunity to do that, you know, as many times as he does, obviously.
Yes.
I would guess that would be hard to keep fresh, but maybe not. Uh-huh. Maybe not. There's a certain kind of repertoire, very traditional repertoire, as in my recital last night, that I enjoy. I don't particularly care to do abstract modern things.
Mm-hmm. And is that because it doesn't engage a part of you?
I think so. I can't relate to it on an emotional level. Unless it's so well written that there's something... some of the newer composers are managing to find that. There's a flutist in the East by the name of Robert Dick who can do things with the flute that I'll never do in a lifetime, partly because he's developed a whole new language. He plays in quarter tones, and he can run scales in quarter tones, for instance, and play multiphonics, split tones and things. I don't happen to use that in my everyday life, and I don't have the same kind of interest, but he also composes. And because he has now a whole new, what I call, arsenal of weapons or mechanical things at his disposal, you know, there are many things that he can do, but he will engage me on an emotional level with his compositions, for instance. There are some people going back now. The composer on Sunday's concert, Shui Chen, spoke in an interview of going back, that the composers now are going back to wanting to use melody and emotional content, not just things for the cerebral. Good news, I think.
Yes, we're going back to move forward in music. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Luis de Tullio is our guest. She is, as I said earlier, a flutist with, or a principal flutist rather, with three symphony orchestras. She began with the Los Angeles Philharmonic. How old were you?
19.
19 years old. And played with that orchestra for the next 6 years. She has played also with the LA Chamber Orchestra, the California Chamber Orchestra, and the Carmel Bach Festival, and been the principal flutist for each of these orchestras in turn. She was also the principal flutist for the Columbia Symphony Orchestra. That was an orchestra that was formed, my understanding is, for the sole purpose of performing and recording all the works of Igor Stravinsky. That was done by Columbia Records, and recently, 2 years ago, I think, re-released by Sony Classics. It is a 22 compact disc set, an extraordinary thing to produce, and I would think for lovers of Stravinsky, an extraordinary thing to have in the home. I'm Susan McGinnis for Conversations. It's my pleasure today to welcome Luis de Tullio to our program on KUAC. I want to ask you about this return to melody, but it's branching off from that. When you play, are you playing with all the parts of Luis de Tullio, and are there kinds of music that engage all the parts of you, intellect, emotion, body, spirit? Is that a valid question? Is there music that brings all of you to life?
It's a valid question. I don't know that I've ever brought that up to the surface as something that I've looked at. Mm-hmm. Certainly in teaching, I try to communicate to my students. It certainly is an engagement in terms of the physical plane of one's whole body, certainly from here up.
From the hips up.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because you use all of the breathing mechanism, which takes you all the way very low for the diaphragm support. And it can be back-breaking work. I mean, you know, it's not easy if you're going to play with a lot of power and energy and enough sound that's going to carry somewhere, and depending what you're expressing, but even the syrinx, of course, takes...
Yes, beautiful piece of
music. To have the breath control. Your whole body is engaged in that, yeah. Mm-hmm. And an interesting thing, and also something I love to share with my students when trying to communicate to them in breathing and in using the body, we do that very much like a singer, only I think a singer does even more so. Mm-hmm. And there's a California baritone by the name of Doug Lawrence, who's been on the international stage, has a wonderful, rich baritone voice. And once in the Carmel Bach Festival, I was sitting, we were both on the apron of the stage, but he was doing the part of Jesus in probably the St. Matthew Passion, and his chair was directly in front of my music stand, and he stood to sing right in front of that. And we were on the apron of the stage, so it was hollow underneath, and it's an old building. And Doug began to sing, and with each breath, the thrust went clear into the floor so that the floorboards actually made incredible noise. And my stand and my chair were moved. I could feel him physically breathing. That's the kind of power that can go into the breathing and to make, for instance, a voice that resonates like that.
Yes.
I never forgot it. I mean, it was just an amazing thing.
There was such a thing, only differently, that I witnessed in watching you in recital, especially when you were doing the variations on Carmen. Mm-hmm. It felt like your body pulled in, and then there was an explosion when you took your breath. It was, I mean, I could feel the expansion and intensity. The person sitting next to me said she's incredibly physical, and I watched that to source it, and it seemed to be all in the breath. Mm-hmm. Is it all in the breath?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Actually, that's really the source of the whole sound, and this shapes. This shapes and it directs the air.
The shape
of the
mouth.
But the source of the sound is not here. It really is very much, very deep in the body.
When you're saying here for our listeners, Louise is saying around the face and mm-hmm. upper throat.
Because the obvious thing, of course, is, you know, you're blowing here.
Across your lips.
But the source of all of that is way down here. So one can't divorce this. The mouth itself shapes and directs how high or low you're going to blow into the instrument, which will depend how high or low the sound is, you know, the pitches are going to be. But people get into trouble thinking that that's where the...
It's the blow.
It's the blow.
Right.
It's not at all.
So the mouth is the dispatcher, but
right.
the energy is.
Right.
Whenever you begin to play, I was watching this at the recital as well, you make just a minute adjustment, and that is...
Sometimes where I'm just wiping the mouthpiece
oh,
just to
all right.
keep from sliding over it.
And
especially when one has worked up a bit of energy and a bit of a sweat.
And this is also just a kind of checking the flute, right? We're all
sometimes
together and ready to go.
Sometimes, you know, whether it's tuning the way I want it to tune, then this top piece moves in or out and will change how high or low the pitch is.
Oh, I see. So you're also extending the tube.
That's correct.
Or shrinking the tube by
right.
doing that.
Right. And that makes it a little sharper or a little flatter.
Interesting. Louise DiTullio, our guest today on Conversations. I'm Susan McGinnis. You were talking about the instrument and the body. It seems to me that this is an upper body instrument as well as a full trunk instrument. Do you have to look after your shoulders and arms as a musician? And this is part of a kind of a question I have for you about the life of a musician being similar to the life of an athlete. Do you have obligations to your body as a musician that I might not have as a person who works in broadcasting?
Oh, I guess one could. Most of us don't until we're already in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, aches and pains, as the life of a musician has become more demanding and the hours are longer, there is such a thing as music medicine that has just erupted, certainly in this hemisphere. I know there's a whole clinic in Toronto, and I believe there may be one I just heard about in the LA area. And I know there are more. One develops all kinds of aches and pains. I mean, you know, this is not a normal.
Sure, no, the way your arms are curved and the
shoulders. The head turns this way, and it's very difficult to spend hours doing this and get tired and be under nervous tension and not start pulling muscles.
And the neck and upper shoulders.
In the
and
neck
upper
and
back.
The older, through here, this shoulder gets weird, the arm gets weird, and, you know, many people have developed carpal tunnel syndrome. The first flutist of the New York Philharmonic has had the whole left hand built out so that she could play again.
Amazing.
Because she plays an instrument. I'm a real maverick. When I play, most people wouldn't be caught dead playing this instrument. But that's okay. It keeps me out of trouble. But she plays one where the wrist has to come way down so that one can reach keys that are set very close here.
Louise
and if you play, if you play very many hours like this, it doesn't take much imagination to see that you can stifle blood flow to nerves and things.
So how's the old horse holding up after 30 years or so of
doing
this?
Well, the old horse.
Forgive me for asking.
No, that's okay. It hurts. hurts. It hurts to practice. If I have to practice a lot of hours, more exercise does help. Mm-hmm. But if one looks at a spinal x-ray of my back, it's pretty scary. It's a bit like a corkscrew. The lower back actually has turned 45 degrees.
Well, see, I was noticing that about your body at the recital as well, that your hips were straight on, but your shoulders were turned, mm-hmm. which is the way you had just turned just a moment ago.
Yeah.
And that's what's doing that.
More than likely, yeah. I mean, you can't spend that many hours a day and not have something move, you know, unless you spent that many hours, you know, as many mm-hmm. rotating the other way.
Poor occupational hazards. Mm-hmm. Now, sure. Here's another question. You put incredible energy into your performance. When you're done performing, are you ready to go out and run a mile or have dinner or go to sleep or go to a party? What happens to all that energy at the end of a 2-hour
usually
performance?
Go eat. We went last night and had a hamburger and
go
french
have
fries.
Dinner. Yeah.
It's not too good for one's weight, but... But on the other hand, I probably burned off as many calories doing that performance, so...
Well, that seemed like a logical option to me because of the burning of calories mm-hmm. or energy in the performance.
I find it very difficult even after an orchestra concert, which doesn't expend nearly the kind of nervous energy, for instance, much less physical energy, that one gets up in an emotional sense, and some people can go home and go to bed. I can't. Mm-hmm. I find that I need some time just to unwind, and I may be dead tired, but there's a part of you that's still very stimulated.
Yes, intellect or emotions or mm-hmm. something.
Or certainly. All of that.
Or yeah. all of it, yeah. Luis de Tullio, our guest on Conversations. Tell me about the life of a freelance musician. Is this...
It's nuts.
It's nuts.
It's one that's been alternately fulfilling. I mean, I really have the best of all worlds in music, I think.
Because
when I left the Los Angeles Philharmonic, everybody thought I would miss it, you know, and I thought that I would go back. I was, through some weird circumstances, I went from being the assistant principal flutist to the piccolo player for 5 of the 6 years, and I really wanted to play first flute, and felt I would never do it. I was working then, Zubin Mehta had come in, and... Felt he would never want to move me over. It's harder to find a good piccolo player than a good flute player. So, due to lots of things, with that being a major reason, I left and figured I would audition when I went back. Well, in the meantime, I got so busy in the studios and had so many things on the outside, as with the Stravinsky recordings, and I was leading such a varied life, doing a certain amount of things like this, going and doing solos in different places. The Philharmonic was totally confining. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm incredibly lucky in that way. Where I'm not lucky is that to do all of these things that I want to do, it's so incredibly time-consuming that it's a total drain on my life. And I'm having to look now again at how to start having some fun. You know, it's time.
This is kind of the hazard of success that
I think so, you know. And it's not something, you can pick and choose to a degree, but if one isn't available for certain projects, for people that you work for, or more to the point, for people you haven't worked for, you know, there's a whole account, say, that's gone, that probably won't come back to you.
Yeah, I don't know about de Tullio. She said no the last time I asked her, right?
And yeah, or this person did just great, and so, you know, that's fine, call him again.
Sure.
So there's always some of that, and it's real hard to have the courage and the self-esteem and the whole thing going that says, it's okay, I can do without that. Sure. You know, I don't need to work 24 hours a day every day. Yeah, but you're always aware that if you don't do that one, they may not call back. On the other hand, one has no clones. So, you know, there are always the days that you can't be in two places at once anyway. So it all, you know, it's taken a lot of years. But I finally come to the point of realizing that is a fact of life. And it's getting easier to say no.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about three symphonies. Can you, being the principal flutist for three symphony orchestras, works because they have different time seasons, is that right? Or are you playing for one or two or three at once?
Well, that really, I mean, talk about crazy. Yeah, you've got certain obligations, you know. Pacific Symphony requires that I make 7 out of 9 weeks of subscription concerts. That's contractual.
But that's not just 7 out of 9 weeks. That's also rehearsal time, and or that's not 7 dates,
well,
for example.
A subscription concert will take 4 rehearsals or 5 rehearsals and 2 programs. And most of those happen at night. So that's a week effectively put aside for that pair of concerts. They do a lot of other things too that contractually I don't necessarily have to do. I'll do maybe half of them. But then that has to fit with the Pasadena Symphony, and there's always one or two that conflict. Mm-hmm. The Hollywood Bowl sort of, that's new. We've had 3 summers now, and I never intended ever to go back to the Hollywood Bowl. You know, that's the summer home of the LA Philharmonic. Mm-hmm. And I was real glad to be done with that. And I'm ending life where I started. It's pretty ironic. But there's some reasons I do that, not the least of which are the recordings. But where I used to have the summer off, the Pacific Symphony has started a summer series. And they're talking about growing that one because they're making a lot of money from it. And the Hollywood Bowl is talking about growing that series. And so up to now, those are now optional things. One can do some of them and not all of them, and so it's kind of sometimes deciding what program I want to do most and just trying to make everybody happy, you know, by being there as much as possible. But the Hollywood Bowl with the 16 recordings, on Earth Day come the spring, they're recording, releasing a record that we did a year ago, August now, and I got to record Afternoon of the Fun. Now, as a freelancer, not with the major orchestra any longer.
Yes.
That's sort of a dream that one never expects to come true. So you don't just throw those opportunities away if one likes to play, which obviously I do. Mm-hmm. So I try my damnedest to balance, juggle all this stuff, and compromise it all and make it work. It's very hard. And they're not making it any easier. Everybody went, in this crazy economy, everybody's still, they're growing. It's remarkable. Pacific Symphony is incredible.
Well, this is something I wanted to ask you about. People have in the last, well, maybe it's just the end of the 80s and maybe the beginning of the 90s is something different is happening. But people have been saying this is a terrible time for the world of art. We've got symphonies and museums struggling for money, and boy, we just don't know where art's going to end up in this economy. But you're talking about the Pacific and the Pasadena deciding to expand further into seasons because they're doing so well. Is it that their music directors are extraordinary, or what?
The Pacific Symphony is in the right place. It's in an area in Orange County, which is a huge population to draw from. It's 50 miles from downtown Los Angeles, which is where the LA Philharmonic is. Mm-hmm. Many of those people don't want to struggle through the traffic, and I mean there's traffic 24 hours a day between those 2 points, and I can tell you that because I do it to get down there. It's a 50-mile drive one way that's just not fun. Mm-hmm. And so to have a really fine orchestra in their own backyard is something that they're beginning to treasure. The people who are doing the fundraising are doing an excellent job of it. They're also in an area near Newport Beach and Laguna, and God help us if the fires have burned down enough of our benefactors, you know, it could make a difference. Mm-hmm. There is money. There are people with money, and some people with enough money to be able to make a major difference. Their endowment fund has been growing through the generosity of a couple of people. And it's looking mm-hmm. good. The summer season has helped a lot. We've been in a venue where there's lots of green lawns and things, and one can picnic like you can't picnic at the Hollywood Bowl. I mean, you can actually spread the blankets out and whole big families come and have a great party before they ever go to the concert. And So it's become socially a really good thing there, and it has been growing, but it's also been well managed.
Well, and this is the next question. What makes, in your mind, internally, not the external funders or support of the community, but what makes an orchestra thrive, become whatever its potential is?
Some of it is the conductor mm-hmm. and the kind of energy he puts out to the community. And our conductor of the last, I guess, four seasons now, Carl St. Clair, is an up-and-comer. He's going to be on the world stage. And in fact, he's conducting the New York Philharmonic this season, so he's
on a springboard.
Oh, yeah, he's just about there. He has four more years with us under contract, I believe. That's part of the energy. He has incredible, just boundless energy. The other thing that's unique to these groups that I play in and to the Southern California area is the motion picture business itself, which is populated by people like myself who come up with a classically trained background. Many of us have been in a major orchestra, or at least in an orchestra where one gets enough experience doing that, where we want to play. And we can do studio music all day long, and I love doing that. It's not challenging except for, you know, now and then a score by John Williams or something, in the same way that playing real classical music is. So it's one thing to do, and it can be wonderful fun, and it pays very well, and it affords you then to take the time off and go play good music. There is an enthusiasm that comes from an orchestra that is populated by people who do something else for a living, but who are also eminently qualified to do the job of playing in a symphony orchestra. You can't match that. I'm sorry, and somebody's going to tell the LA Philharmonic I said this. You can't match that on a 52-week a year contract, because it becomes a job. And they may come up to a certain performance with a conductor who particularly inspires them, but it doesn't have the same kind of energy and zeal that people like myself who do maybe 20 weeks of concerts a year rather than 52, bring to doing something that I go down there and I do it for fun. They can't begin to pay me what it's costing me to turn down the work I turn down. So I bring it with it that I want to be here, and so does everyone else.
So this is love.
This is love. But it catches on, you see, with the audiences too. There's an inner spirit that goes out. And we keep trying to tell the powers that be in management, don't lose this. I don't think they'll ever quite appreciate, until I've done something to blow it up, how valuable that property is. You know, they want more and more of our time and more of a commitment. And when that happens, they will wind up with a ho-hum group who are just doing a job. And it'll change. That'll change. But for now, there's a wonderful enthusiasm. It's like going to a summer festival. Everybody takes a busman's holiday.
Is this or isn't this family? Do you have a bit of a family at Pacific and
yes.
Pasadena? And
yes.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, that's true. And I remember my days in the LA Philharmonic is so miserably unhappy. And I would say it was like living in one very big unhappy family, where you're there, you know, without the bonds of love. With people that you have to see every day. Now, yeah, sure, you have friends, but in those days particularly, I don't know what it's like anymore, but there was a lot of inner friction and inner tension that made it not fun at all. That was a job I was glad to leave, and that's sad, because it was a job I always wanted.
It's amazing how you, I don't know, find your life differently than you thought you would. And this is exactly what I want. Ooh, that's not what I want at all.
Yeah, not as long as it's going to be like it was. And there are lots of things behind that. You know, I have some personal things I wouldn't talk about. But but yeah, it made it so I didn't care if I never went back. I was just having this, I mean, I do all kinds of things. It's wonderful.
Louise DiTullio with us today on Conversations. She's been a soloist for a number of orchestras, of course the Pasadena and Pacific, for which she's the principal flutist, Boston Pops, Glendale Symphony, Monterey and Modesto Symphonies, all three in California, the LA Chamber Orchestra, and many others throughout the state of California. If you're curious, and I'm sure you are, about films she's played with, if you bring home a video this weekend, listen for The River Runs Through It, Alive, Dances with Wolves, Hook, Summersby, Aladdin, Rich in Love, Free Willy, all recent films. John Barry was the composer for Dances with Wolves and for two of the Julia Roberts films, Sleeping with the Enemy and Dying Young, for which Louise DiTullio recorded.
I think Jerry Goldsmith did Sleeping with the Enemy, for sure.
Jerry Goldsmith.
One of the wonderful films that I recommend to everybody, Rudy, for its inspiration. Jerry Goldsmith did the music for that.
All right.
There's some wonderful flute solos in there, too. I got to go see that, and I really did get a kick out of it.
When you see a film that you've recorded for, is it a different experience than seeing a film? Do you wait for...
I don't wait for it, but, you know, a lot of times they bury it, so you've played your heart out, you think, and it's gone because the director or somebody gets scared that it's going to get in the way of the dialogue or something. And then other times they want to hear the music right out front, and Rudy was that way in the main title. It was all of a sudden the flute just filled the screen. I've been doing this for a lot of years, and I still get a boot out of it.
Nice.
Yeah, it really is.
Very nice. Tell me about reviews. Do you pay attention at all to reviews? I've read some extraordinary reviews of your performances, and I, when I was reading them, I thought, now how would she react to this? Or if someone said, well, I don't know, she noodled effectively or something like that, would one raise you up and the other drop you low? Or does that matter?
The truth of it is, it can't matter a whole lot. I mean, one hopes not to be embarrassed. Especially if it's your hometown, and everybody's going to see it, then you hope it's a good review. But my experience has been that I've been to so many concerts where I felt the reviewer was in a totally different program. I mean, they thought he didn't come and phoned in something, that he made up, or just had a fight with his wife over dinner or something. And, sometimes they're right on and sometimes they're really wrong. And I have to go by the way I know, You know pretty well whether you did well or not.
Right. So it's something like the editing of the music for the film. It's out of your hands once you do the performance.
Oh, absolutely. Right. Sometimes they just simply won't look at a piece of music for what it is. The Carmen Fantasy, for instance. If I played that in Los Angeles and a serious reviewer came, he'd probably throw brickbats just because I played that. Well, there's a reason for playing a piece like that, and it has nothing to do with plumbing the depths of music. Mm-hmm. It has to do with the audience that you're playing for, or just simply presenting a variety of things. And that kind of music has a place in the history of flute playing. Mm-hmm. And it's accessible to people. And I think you take it for what it is. It wasn't meant to be, esoteric. It just isn't. So look at it that way. Have a good time with it.
Well, now you've brought me to a question I've been curious about. Was there a composer or a time, a century, that created perfect music for flute? Or is this a matter of preference? Again, it depends on how you come to a piece of music and who you are.
I think the latter would be true. We all have our preferences, what moves us more. How could anyone say anything is more perfect than Bach? And I love to play Bach, but I love to play many other things too. Mm-hmm. So you just try to achieve a balance and do things that you're comfortable doing, that you feel you can bring something to, that you can say something with. Or that will have meaning for your audience. I will always try to tailor a program to my audience. And the critics be damned.
And what does that mean for you when you create a program? When you sit down to build a program, what goes through your mind?
Who I'm playing for is the uppermost question. What kinds of things will they enjoy? What will I enjoy bringing to them? Mm-hmm. And if I'm told that these people are very knowledgeable about music and they like 20th century music, then I'll dig into the bag for some things that I might not otherwise program and try to bring some of that to them. In an audience like Fairbanks, I don't know exactly what I'm getting, although I was told that people enjoy good music and will be discerning. I just tried to bring them a varied program, feeling that there would be a variety of kinds of people and sophistication.
Mm-hmm. Is this a wonderful time to be a flute player in general? Is the flute a welcomed instrument in our culture at this time?
I think so. I think more so, certainly, than 30 years ago. things have changed very much. Ron Paul and Galway have brought the flute onto the concert stage where no one would put you out there. I mean, as a young woman, I would do solos with community orchestras, but in front of a major symphony, there were never traveling soloists.
Because,
and now there are several.
Because the culture's ear was not attuned to that sound?
They didn't take it so seriously, I think. And they felt people wouldn't pay the money, you know, to buy the tickets to go see a flute player, go hear a flute player.
Is that because in part women play flutes? That's not true, is it?
No, I don't know.
No. What is that?
No. And if you go to a convention, you see there are many men. I mean, right. If you think about who populates the first chairs in major orchestras.
I think I just grabbed at the straw. Was it just that it hadn't evolved to its place in the culture?
Part of it, I think, is just simply the repertoire. There's a lack of really, I mean, we don't have Brahms and Tchaikovsky and meaty things like that to play. Mm. People are starting to write some pretty good things. Mm-hmm. So it'll become more so. But someone like Ron Paul built her reputation through records. He had good management. Mm-hmm. And, once you become a household name, then they feel they can sell tickets.
And sell tickets to the instrument as mm-hmm. well as to the artist.
That's right.
So James Galway and Jean-Pierre Rampal opened doors for flutists everywhere.
I think so. Particularly Jean-Pierre.
Uh-huh. How kind.
It was great. I mean, groundbreakers. I know Galway suffered a lot of criticism for playing mm-hmm. a lot of the classical or the pop stuff that he has. On the other hand, he also built an audience. You know, people will go hear him play Mozart because they're familiar with Annie's Song or something. You know, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I don't think one can argue with that. Although, speaking of critics, I've seen him just lambasted in the LA Times for having done such a thing. Yeah. I think if it works, why not?
Absolutely.
I mean, this is a time where there is no money to educate. And I think our people, I'm going to get on my soapbox here.
Go ahead.
We need music and the arts to nurture the souls of our population. And as we remove those things from the curriculum of our schools, and we acquaint our children with only the violence that they see on television, we are removing the food to their souls and the windows to their souls, not giving them the opportunities to express themselves in the soft ways. We are only teaching them to be hard and violent. And I think our society is suffering already. And unless we can turn this around as people and parents and artists of all descriptions, our society is in for a very bad time. I don't think we can remove this from the curriculum, that we can take culture out of our society and hope to survive as human beings who are caring people. And we've also removed the opportunity for children to possibly find a career. I mean, if you're not exposed to dance or to art or to music mm-hmm. as a young person, how do you know whether you have talent there or not? We're robbing our children. That's my soapbox.
Thank you for it. Luis de Tullio, thank you for a very interesting hour on Conversations.
Thank you, I enjoyed it very much.
It's been a pleasure to have you with us, and may you always play wonderful music. And thank you for listening. I'm Susan McGinnis. This has been Conversations. I hope you join me again next week. Thanks.